Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Turning now to the world's newest nation, the Republic of South Sudan, gaining independence from Sudan in 2011 with 98% of the public vote. Since then, however, this landlocked country in northeastern Africa has struggled with internal conflict and now is consuming itself in a bloody civil war. In December 2013, fighting erupted between the government troops and rebel factions, and within weeks, thousands had been killed, and now more than a million people have been forced to flee their homes. This young country is also facing a major humanitarian crisis, with widespread food and water shortages and some of the worst health indicators in the world. Australian organisations continue to play a vital role in the provision of aid, and the Australian Defence Force have contributed military aircraft to aid the rescue effort in South Sudan. Dr. Melissa Phillips is an honorary fellow in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne, and has worked with refugees and NGOs around the world, including South Sudan. Melissa, thank you for joining in the conversation. This isn't merely an academic pursuit for you, is it? You've seen life firsthand in South Sudan.
Absolutely, Duane. I have a long history with South Sudan, and I first went there in 2005, just after the peace agreement had been signed. I was part of a group of Australians who had been funded by what was then AusAid at the time to go over to work with displaced people, helping them return back to their villages and homes after the comprehensive peace agreement had been signed in early 2005.
What were your developing impressions when you landed and started to meet the people as they came back for what was supposed to be peace?
I had been lucky enough already to work in Australia with some of the many South Sudanese who'd been resettled by the Australian Department of Immigration. Many of them were living and working in parts of Sydney and Melbourne, and I had been working with a program run by Anglicare at the time. So I already had a close connection with people of South Sudanese origin living in Australia. And so when I went over, it was absolutely wonderful to be able to see the place that they'd talked about, to see the land. Much like Australia, South Sudan is a very large country with some wonderful geography, and that was my first impression, was of this incredible countryside, and also these the people who had suffered so much during decades of civil war and were so enthusiastic about the opportunities of peace and what it held for them in the future.
Was it the kind of country even then that the people who were returning were hoping it was going to be? Did it show early signs of finding a peace and an equilibrium that perhaps these people hadn't known in a generation?
Absolutely. It was very, you're absolutely right that there had been generations of not only conflict, but lack of development. People had, because of the history of South Sudan with its decades-long conflict, but also the colonial legacy where the South had been kept very much underdeveloped, people had been denied sort of access to basic services like healthcare, education, and the South Sudanese were very hungry for peace. They had fought hard during the war for what they believed was, their right, their land, and access to politics so that they could be in control of their own territory. And they were most enthusiastic about what peace brought for them. So there was a great jubilation and an enthusiasm about being able to have some independence and to be able to control their own future. So yes, that was there evident from the beginning. Of course, the legacy of decades of conflict and underdevelopment meant that they had a very low base from which to commence.
Melissa, was there a sense within you that there were troubled waters ahead? And did you expect what is now happening to come as quickly as it has done?
Yes. It's the hindsight is a wonderful thing, isn't it? It was certainly at the time, there was a very early setback in the peace agreement in South Sudan in 2005 when Dr. John Garang, who'd been the leader of the South Sudanese People's Liberation Army, died in a helicopter accident. He had been the broker of the peace, and he'd been the sort of visionary figure that had united the South Sudanese people. It's not to say there weren't already cracks between different tribal groups, but Dr. John Garang had a vision of what he called New Sudan, and he wanted to connect the cause of South Sudanese with other marginalised groups in Sudan, such as the Darfuri people. And when he died in July 2005, this was very much a setback for that uniting cause. And people were very concerned about what would happen at that point. However, the South Sudanese held it together. For them, the eye on the prize was their opportunity in 2011 to vote to either remain as part of Sudan,
yeah,
or to vote for independence. And people were very keen to make sure that that was the goal that they reached. However, as we know in other contexts, once sometimes that sort of unifying focus or the common enemy has gone, some of the internal cracks start to appear. A lot of the issues that South Sudan faces now were evident at that time. Also, around the focus at the time was on peace. What a lot of people now realise is that we also needed to focus on justice, reconciliation and forgiveness.
And that's a fairly understandable response, in so much as if you're looking to keep peace, I can understand a reluctance to start raking over old coals and thinking long and hard about injustices that had gone before. But in a very real way, that's an important part of reconciliation, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's the sort of fundamental objectives of reconciliation are to, as you said, to rake over old hurts and pains, and not just what was done to the South Sudanese by the North, but also what was done amongst the South Sudanese to each other. There's been a lot of focus on the tribal tensions, and that's one component of it. And there's also issues about access to power and to resources. South Sudan, on top of all of this, is a country that, depending on your perspective, is either cursed or blessed with oil. And that permeates all of these issues today, where there's oil in the most northern part of South Sudan. And so there's also a large cost, there potentially is a large prize in South Sudan from the resources that come with oil. So that this adds another dimension to what's already a very complex political situation.
Are we talking about a purely internal conflict in a state that is now devouring itself because of a lack of infrastructure and an understanding of each other's needs? Or what is driving this?
At one level is very much the internal tensions and cracks between South Sudanese becoming more apparent once this sort of common enemy has gone. And also, sadly, some of the more recent violence has been incited by hate speech on the radio, which is a very worrying development. So these, as you said, as you asked, these issues at some level are very much internally driven. However, oil also plays a role, and many people also still point to the fact that there is regional interests in South Sudan that are also playing a part.
I don't mean to be inflammatory in this conversation, but this is sounding very Rwanda-esque.
Yes, yes. It definitely, when we start talking about hate speech on the radio,
yeah,
and the massacres of particular ethnic groups, people do hark back to what we've seen in other places like Rwanda. And that should be a real sort of warning bell for us about, you know, what needs to be done, the lessons that we have to learn from Rwanda. But similarly, I would hope that we don't then assume that massacres and genocide becomes inevitable. There is an opportunity to put some brakes on this. There are African Union-sponsored a commission of investigation occurring at the moment. But this is what's happening at the larger political level. What we also need to remember is that, you know, South Sudanese people themselves need to become owners of the peace that they fought for. And for me, in this regard, one of the biggest civil society groups in South Sudan and one of the most important is the church. It's always played a vital role in addressing issues faced by ordinary people, and it has a fundamentally important role to play in the objectives of reconciliation and forgiveness and brokering that. And also, it's a place that people can come to air grievances and have discussions. So there's also, as much as there's some real alarm bells at the moment, there's also some important opportunities that we need to grab now.
Melissa, there'll be many who are listening to this conversation feeling a certain humanitarian atrocity overload in that we have these kinds of stories coming to us quite frequently.
Yeah.
How can we break through that perception that, oh, it's another conflict and it's so big and it's so broad? What really can I do about it here?
Yes, as you said, these events often seem so far away. They're in places that we can't imagine. Sometimes my family would say to me, Melissa, it's like you're on another planet. We really can't imagine the environment that you're in or the context of South Sudan. For me, it obviously the human stories are what cuts through, that people are looking for the same things that you and I are, which is about a safe life, shelter, education for their families. For me, I think about many of the South Sudanese that I was privileged enough to get to know when I was there for 4 years, and particularly for me as somebody who's benefited from an education in Australia, some of the young women that I spoke to who simply were fatigued from decades of conflict. They were tired and they wanted basically to be able to sort of sleep at night without having to worry about being displaced or about conflict. They were excited about the possibility of planting seeds in their farm so that they could become independent. And they were enthusiastic about the opportunities that education meant for them. South Sudan still had one of the highest maternal mortality rates, which is changing. But one of the fastest improvements was in girls' education. So South Sudan was very enthusiastic to see that the South Sudanese government really wanted to see that girls got an education, that the education system improved and changed. So for me, as an Australian, I felt that this was a country that was wanting to get to stand up on its own two feet. It wasn't asking for handouts. It was asking for sort of genuine partnership. The thing that I think Australians can do, as you said, we're sometimes fatigued with crises or being asked to help. I think we can look at how best we can do that through organisations that we support already, through some of the non-government organisations that some of the South Sudanese have started. There's some very interesting groups that are being run by South Sudanese Australians who are trying to help broker peace. And they are, I think, provide very exciting opportunities for peace dialogue. And of course, there are bigger charities that we all know of that are working in South Sudan to try to help stabilise the situation so that there can be a bit of a hiatus on conflict and a focus, a return back to the focus that South Sudan had over a year ago.
Dr. Melissa Phillips, thank you for your insight. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Dr. Melissa Phillips from the University of Melbourne. Nayadol Nayuan is a South Sudanese-Australian who was raised in refugee camps in Kenya until she was 15. Since arriving in Australia, Nayadol completed her high schooling and then a law degree. Today she works tirelessly to increase the awareness of issues affecting the lives of African Australians, with a particular passion for youth and women's issues. Nayadol joined us from a train on the way to work and it got a bit noisy at times, so forgive the background. We started with how Nayadol's life today has been framed by growing up in a refugee camp.
I think it influenced a lot of my daily living. It influenced how I interact with people. It influenced how I view certain debates, predominantly the whole issue of asylum seekers and queue jumpers. And from a personal perspective, you are always aware of being in a similar situation. And I always tell people that the idea that someone jumped a queue or that there is a queue in the first place is somewhat false, because if I had a boat, I would have taken one. I just did not have a boat where I was. But it does influence a lot of my attitude towards most things I come in contact with, whether it's even the opportunity or the privilege of having an education, whether it's the fact that now I can actually say that I love my family because I know my family finally. I mean, things like that, you don't have the opportunity to really appreciate in a refugee camp.
Did you choose Australia or was it offered to you?
We didn't really choose, I suppose, Australia. In a way, maybe Australia chose us since we had relatives already living here.
Share with us some of your experiences when you came to this fabulous country, and what were the biggest surprises and what were the greatest joys when you first got here?
Well, my biggest goal was to go to university. That was my greatest aim, and I prayed almost every night when I was in the refugee camp that the Australia government will approve our proposal, or will approve our resettlement application, and I'll finally get a chance to go to university. So I was able to do that and complete my Bachelor of Arts, and then went on to apply to do law, which I wanted to do since I was 14 and had no idea how I was going to get there. So it's that has to be, I think, the greatest moment for me being here. But just the little joys, or you know, having having a safe environment to live in, waking up and not being worried that you wake up tomorrow and everything you have will be gone. Although I think life generally can still do that, but I think that it's much safer now. Being able to see my brothers and sisters go to school every morning, having enough food in the fridge. I can go on. it's a lot of things I'm quite appreciative of, and that still surprised me almost 9 years later. You know, I sometimes catch myself in the train thinking, wow, you know, I'm here. You know, I'm not still at a refugee camp. So, yeah.
Are we the country that we feel we are when it comes to refugees and people finding safety and a home in our place?
Yeah. I think as I mature, both as an adult, but as also I think the longer I stay here and the more I feel that I'm becoming Australian, whatever I think that means for me, I'm beginning to see things that I think in my initial, I suppose, honeymoon period coming here, I didn't see. I only saw, you know, very clean roads and very neat street light and the opportunity to go to school and the safety and everything, and I appreciate all those things, but I think I've also experienced, you know, discrimination because of how I look, how I sound, and I remember telling a friend one that sometimes I feel that I'm always going to be too tall and too black to be Australian, but you know, and some of it was really bad. So when my family was in Ballarat, for example, we experienced almost daily racial abuse and targeting on the street, you know, being called black dogs and, you know, even having things thrown at my little brothers and sisters.
Goodness.
So, I mean, it was quite full on. And myself as well, just walking down on the street, you know, I've been called twice, just walking down a normal street, I've been called a nigger. So, I mean, you do feel sometimes that in a sad way that you're being displaced from claiming an identity of what it is to be an Australian. I suppose, you know, that's the reality of life generally. The refugee camp had its own challenges. I think Australia also have its own set of challenges. It's been very difficult, for example, for my family to find permanent housing. We've constantly been moving up and down since we came to this country. You know, both on a personal level, and then there's been some challenges. There's also, I suppose, you know, and equally towards my own progress of trying to feel Australian. There have been struggles, whether it is the way that I've been received by other people or whether it's the difficulties that I've faced myself in terms of what does it really mean to be a Sudanese Australian? You know, is there anything such as a Sudanese Australian? Am I just kidding myself? And most of the time I feel I am, because on the one hand, I feel like I can never be, you know, an Australian. On the other hand, I don't feel like I'm entirely a Sudanese, and maybe I am just some confused mess between the two that I need to sort out as I grow older.
Nidal, you've chosen to seek out opportunities for advocacy, clearly birthed in your heart as a displaced person, now an Australian. You've worked with Oxfam and the African Think Tank. And as the South Sudanese story continues to evolve, what's the importance for you? How important is it for you to share life as a Sudanese Australian?
Well, I mean, it's kind of been what you said. It's just a way of trying to get people to understand what is going on in South Sudan, and to see also that there is some things that Australia can do. It can put a lot of diplomatic pressure on South Sudan. It has a seat in the UN Security Council, so it can have an influence there. And I know that it has been quite willing to provide aid, for example. But there's a huge population of South Sudanese Australians as well in living here, whether it's in Melbourne or Sydney or other places. that are very that are affected by this war. I know, for example, my life has actually not been the same since the conflict started on the 15th, and it's and I'm very very far away from it. But it's always present on my consciousness. 10,000, at least 10,000 people are estimated to have been killed or more. You know, a million have been displaced, and the conflict is now being described in the two most worst disasters in recent African history, and that is the Rwanda genocide and the Ethiopian famine. So what will occur would be, you know, such a disaster, I suppose, even if you you feel distant from it, it's a disaster for all of us to have, you know, living in one part of the world where everything seems fine, and to have another part of the world, a whole country where a third of its population face extreme food shortages.
Do you have family and friends still in South Sudan?
Yes, I still have my stepbrothers and sisters in South Sudan. I have my boyfriend is in South Sudan. You know, I have a lot of people that are very close to me, and I love dearly that are still in South Sudan. My mother and my grandmother and my uncle, as well as my auntie, were all caught up in this when the fighting started on the 15th. You know, so they were even some of the people that went to the UN compound to try and seek refuge because of the nature of the conflict, which initially just took a very ethnic turn. You know, so there was a targeting of a particular tribe, which is the tribe I came from, during the first few days of the conflict in Juba, which resulted to nearly 20,000 people or more running to the UN compound to try and seek safety. And those included my own mother, my uncle, my grandmother, and my auntie. So I have been to some degree impacted by this conflict. But I don't know. I can almost say I don't know any Southern Sudanese that you can talk to that haven't already been impacted by this conflict. A lot of people have already lost a lot of people.
Nidal, at a time where perhaps many Australians are looking at their own lives and complaining about many of the decisions that are made around us by our governments, there are those amongst us right now from South Sudan who are fearing for their family and friends who have virtually nothing right now. What would you like us to understand, either about our role or what we can do from here?
I think the first thing is that we should not feel helpless if there's nothing that we can do. I mean, there have been a lot of efforts put into campaigns, whether it's the Konyi campaign, you know, try and find Konyi in northern Uganda,
yeah,
or whether it is the, you know, the 200, sadly 200 Nigerian girls still missing. A lot of international pressure is being put in because we as I think as human beings share that collective feeling of that this is something unacceptable anywhere in this world, whether it's doesn't matter that it's not happening in our backyard. We share that feeling that this is unacceptable. So we should not feel that Australia has no role. I think Australia can play a significant role in trying to get these two leaders to come together and sit on the table and discuss matters and hold them accountable for the things that they do not want to implement. They can do that as part of the international community, as part of the UN, or they can do that on their own initiative. I think the government here, unfortunately, has been relatively reluctant in voicing its opinion about the current conflict in South Sudan. I can understand that their priorities are somewhere else, but I think that when you have so many Southern Sudanese here, and when you have, you know, a huge number of people facing famine, and you have talked of genocide, that this become something that is important for all of us, whether you're South Sudanese or not. So we can indeed put pressure on our government to try and do more and speak more and be much more visible about its position on the current conflict and how it wants it resolved. And I think that people will pay attention. There's so many Australians in South Sudan who are working there, who are either in parliament or just working locally. So I think there will be people paying attention to what Australia say. And South Sudan is such a small country that its relationship with other countries outside of it is important. So it will value its relationship with Australia, and it will want to explore that relationship in the future. And that is a relationship that Australia can demonstrate is being put at risk if the leaders do not change their current trend. I hope that, you know, people realize that they're definitely not helpless in this situation, and that Australia can do a little bit more.
No, Dahl, it's been fantastic to connect with you. Thank you for sharing your insights into South Sudan with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nyadol Nayuan, one of the thriving South Sudanese Australian community, reminding us that perhaps we have a great deal to be thankful for in this country. Live Connection, an Australian not-for-profit organisation, has been supporting local rural communities and developing nations now since 2000. In 2012, the South Sudanese government invited Live Connection to provide agricultural training in sustainable subsistence farming. We're joined now by the founder and director of Live Connection, Pastor Paul Raverstein. Paul, great to meet you. Thank you for your time. Where did Live Connection begin for you?
Live Connection was, I suppose, birthed out of a vision from when I was just 20 years of age, and I was travelling around Central Africa, building hospitals and schools and churches. And while I was there, I saw incredibly talented, gifted people that have been trained for ministry, but couldn't actually minister because they lived in subsistent rural areas, and they were called to minister in those areas. And the problem is, when you're called to live and work in an area, but you don't have the financial backing, it's very difficult to do what you're called to do, because food costs money, education costs money, medicine costs money, and generally these people were in areas where there's 90% plus unemployment. We provide a very subsistent amount of money, $2 a day. So $2 a day provides the very basic support for a subsistent rural leader, and it's no corruption can come in. There's leadership training. We work with regional leaders in that area, and they have cluster groups of pastors where they come in for leadership training and they support each other. So it's a bit of a unity movement too, because you get a whole group of pastors, even from different denominations, coming together for leadership training. And some of these leaders will go into a dumping area where they'll get 80 or 100 kids, and they've brought them into their church and they've fed them. And they said when they first started to do that, the kids vomited the food up because it wasn't rotten.
Yeah.
And see, these leaders are called to go out into the community to minister with them, to be fathers and mothers. And so we teach, the leadership principles that we all understand in the 20th century, that Christianity is more than just yapping your mouth and sharing the good news. You know, the reason God doesn't drop manna and quail from the sky anymore is because he believes that the love of God in our hearts would cause us to share. But the problem is we've got potentially more than 80% of the wealth with such a small percentage of people.
Paul, you make a compelling argument. There's no doubt about it. Can I ask, have the troubles in South Sudan, which is the topic we're exploring today, made it more difficult to get in there, even at a subsistence level, to support the locals on the ground?
Sure. Actually, when we got to South Sudan, very, 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 very tough country to work in ministry in. And I got there, I was taken there by the chairman of the Duke community, South Sudanese community in Australia. And he took me over there. And when I saw the need there, we work with the Anglican church over there. And when I saw the need there, I realised we had to do more than just provide this basic level of education. Because of the war and the trauma and the effect of this devastating conflict over decades, they'd really lost a lot of the, leadership that may have been passed down in the areas of agriculture and various things. So I decided that what I would do is help in that area. So we decided to build an agricultural training school there. And I've taken leaders from South Sudan and taken them to Zimbabwe, and I've had them trained in through an organization called Foundations for Farming. Now, Foundations for Farming has got incredible principles and a course which can increase the yield by by up to 800%.
Wow.
It's incredible, some of the practices and some of the myths that they actually dispel about farming. At the moment, we have actually decided, especially with all that's going on, that we would change it from an agricultural school to agricultural training school to an agricultural primary school. And the reason being is, as we were there and we travelled, and you know, the vision evolves, there are more 15-year-old girls dying giving birth to children than actually going to school. And this is obviously a situation, because most of the children, there is no hope for them. There's no future. They live in a mud hut, and they don't have the ability for education and to gain knowledge. And they don't have, most of them are orphaned or looked after by their grandparents. And it's not unusual for me to talk to pastors who have lost nearly everybody in their family through the war.
Paul, I think at the heart of it, every one of us of faith wants to be an agent for change. Well done on everything you're already doing through Live Connection. How can we support you guys?
Oh, well, look, I mean, we've got a website where you can go on and you can voice your support through that. I mean, we want to build. I mean, on this property that the government has given us, and we're investing in. We need to build a school there that is going to be a place of hope, a place where the Sudanese people will find, it's almost like it's going to be a well-watered garden, but a place that is going to be one of the places of hope in a country which is devastated, a country that doesn't have roads, a country that doesn't have water, a country that doesn't have sewage, a country that is struggling. We want to have a place of hope where everybody in that Boretown area, where all of the conflict is at the moment, knows that we will not give up on them. We will help build their future. We will invest into their children. When you invest into the children, you invest into the parents, and we'll express love in that way. And then we as the funds come in, we want to we're talking to Sudanese doctors and various people, and we're sourcing how we can best move on to a medical clinic that'll help help in a way that'll make a tangible difference. So we've got a website. Or obviously, we can say that that if you give to Life Connection, that your money is going to go right to the ground, and it's going to be invested into the rural leaders there. And let me tell you, nobody we actually partner with in any country, no matter what level of leadership they have, earn more than $50 a week. Because we're not paying their wage, we're helping their calling.
Paul, brilliant to be able to connect with you. Thanks so much for your time. All the best with the future, and stay safe in South Sudan as well as the other projects around the world, won't you?
Thank you, mate. Yeah, thank you very much.